remind you that you have an obligation over in the clinic if you have not already found your way over there. Secondly, Professor Bertram has asked me to mention to those members of his discussion group groups in particular, and this of course will also hold true for my discussion group, to be prepared to discuss Sullivan's The Coronation of Charlemagne. We will also hopefully discuss any reading that you have done in your text on the whole question of papacy and empire in the sections that meet with me. Today, then, I'd like to complete this last section, the feudal church under C, talking primarily about A and B, first of all, and then moving over into C, the lord's, the ultimate control of the feudal lord, the feudal owner of the property, and the dual character of the priest, first of all, and then of the bishop. We suggested last time that the parish over which the priest normally had spiritual jurisdiction was actually feudally owned by one individual, the lord. Secondly, we attempted to outline the spiritual duties of a parish priest. We suggested that they were, or are, baptism, confession, penance, unction, or burial, and of course, perhaps the most important function of all, he was to regularly speak the Mass. Under Charlemagne, he was required, usually, to give instruction to the children of the parish. Marriages were performed by him. However, whether this was considered a spiritual function or one of his civil functions is a question. He preached. By and large, however, this preaching was either a reading of someone else's sermon rather than something he had done or written on his own. Parish priests, as I mentioned to you last time, were by and large from the lowest farming classes of Franklin. They were not from the nobility or out of noble families, as were the bishops. And consequently, many of them could not have written a sermon if they had desired to do so, and if they had written it, they could not have read it. The stories, of course, about the medieval parish priests are many in number. I would suggest, if you're interested in this kind of human interest history, that you read G.G. Colton's Medieval Panorama. G.G. Colton gives you all of the inside story of the Middle Ages. It reads very much like Lutheran News and Hollywood Confidential. The difficulty with Colton is that he does not recognize the steps that were being taken in the Middle Ages to correct the very abuses that he is portraying. A not uncommon difficulty. In fact, if you check the footnotes of Colton carefully, you will find that a great deal of his material comes precisely from the councils, the local councils that were rehashing the difficulty in order to legislate correction. One of the great curiosities of his account. In any case, as I say, when you read something like this, it does give you a real interesting insight into the kind of people who were parish priests. But it also, but you also have to read it with some reservation. Now, he had these spiritual duties, but a parish priest also had feudal duties, in that the land on which his, the land on which he lived, that he farmed, or his retainers farmed, the land on which his chapel stood. Since this was owned by another man, he owed this individual certain duties. By and large, taxes in the Middle Ages were paid via duties rather than via money. The money exchange was rather unusual in these years prior to Charlemagne and immediately after, since it was a rural economy. Even the tithe that we'll talk about in a moment that were paid to the parish priests were paid normally in kind rather than in the coin. So, you have to read a study of Frankish feudalism to understand this. Charlemagne and his, both his predecessors and his successors, did not live off taxation. They lived off their own land. But there were certain obligations that the various landowners throughout Frankland owed to Charlemagne as a result of the fact that he protected them. Now with the parish priest, it was similarly true. His land was, the land on which his parish building stood was owned by a particular individual who protected it from assault. There was no centralized, strong, centralized, well-administered government in Central Europe, Western and Central Europe, in the early Middle Ages, so everyone had to protect himself. And this is the origin of many of the feudal, dynastic wars, conflicts that took place in these years. This clearly then, the fact that the parish priest owed certain duties to his secular lord, to the owner of the property, made him something of a made him a part of the feudal order. As I said, one of these things could be marriage, that he performed marriages. We think of this as an ecclesiastical right. As you know, many governments today do not think of this as an ecclesiastical right, and there is some question whether it was thought of that way in the early Middle Ages. But more than this, the parish priest was expected to supervise morals in his parish. He was sort of a black-garbed policeman. He had to, it was his duty to control crime or moral infringements, especially in the area of sex, for example. This was all related to the system of penance. He meted out the penance. He was, in effect, then something of a court. Also to seek out incendiaries, murderers, violators of cemeteries, things of this sort. These were the kind of duties that he had as a parish priest in connection with that he did to repay, or this was what he owed to his lord. His feudal dues, F-E-U-D-A-L. The second area where his life is tied into the feudal structure of society in the early Middle Ages is related to the fact that everyone in his parish was required to pay him a tithe. T-I-T-H-E. This tithe, however, was normally not given directly to him, but was paid either to the bishop, who had a number of parishes under his control, or was often paid directly to the feudal lord, of whom the various individuals in the parish were, the farmers in the parish were vassals along with the parish priest. Now this tithe was normally divided into four parts, according to Baldwin. One of them, one-fourth of the tithe was retained by the bishop. Another fourth was used for distribution or for the help of the poor. Another fourth of the tithe was used to repair the church, keep the church and the lands in good repair. And then finally, another fourth was called the benefice of the priest. This was his salary, as it were. I think it's always important to remember that all of these tithes, the whole tithe, was normally given in kind. And consequently, the priest very often didn't get really a fourth of it. At least this is true according to Colton. Now, let's see. Next, I think we'll move over at this point then to the bishop and point this out similarly, and to show similarly how he was also both a civil and a feudal, a spiritual and a feudal functionary. A bishop was normally the priest of a town. A town, of course, was a market town, by and large, in the early Middle Ages, where goods were exchanged. And here is where you had the cathedrals, where there were cathedrals in the early Middle Ages, Romanesque. A priest in a town having a large cathedral and having such a number of people under, a concentrated number of people under his immediate jurisdiction, and then controlling a number of parishes that were served by priests, obviously needed helpers. His assistants in the town churches were called canons. The canons of a cathedral, these were the assistant pastors, I suppose we would have to say today. Sometimes I get a little bit disturbed when people talk about one pastor. Also, this is also true in modern Europe, serving a parish of 10 or 20,000 people. This was seldom the case in the Middle Ages. These bishops all had assistants who were called canons, and if they were absentee bishops, and this was quite often the case, a bishop was from the nobility and did not pay attention to his spiritual duties, but was rather more concerned with his feudal duties. This work was always done by the vicar, who was the replacement for the bishop when he was not there. The use of terms, of course, then and now, varies considerably. So that's the basic structure of the office of bishop. He usually resided in a town, and had control over a number of parishes. Now his spiritual duties at this time were, first of all, to inspect his parishes and to maintain discipline among the parish priests. This is especially true under Charlemagne. One of the things that were Charlemagne, one of the areas where Charlemagne did a great deal of reforming. Prior to the 8th and the 9th century, a bishop was an individual who was a priest of a town, and no more than this. It was Charlemagne who, in great part, passed the legislation and enforced the legislation requiring a priest to really exercise some kind of ecclesiastical discipline over the priests in his parish. As I said, normally this was most unusual coming from the period of Charlemagne. Secondly, the bishop administers confirmation. This is true in Western Europe at this time. It is also true in Eastern Orthodoxy at this time, as well as more recently. This was not the function of the parish priest. Thirdly, the bishop was required to hold a diocesan synod once a year. This also was a requirement of Charlemagne. Now, this is a legal requirement. Of course, this was not always done. Many times it was impossible. But theoretically, this was his duty, to gather his priests together once a year to hold a synod to take up various theological and disciplinary matters. Fourthly, the bishop was required to ordain all of the priests in his diocese. In other words, he had control of holy orders. Fifthly, he maintained a court for diocesan litigation. Those secular courts in the early Middle Ages were few and far between. All of the judicial activity, as we know it today, was by and large carried on by either the priest on the local level, and if he couldn't settle a particular problem, it was appealed to the bishop. And then it came to his court, where most of the important crimes ultimately found their adjudication. In the 10th and 11th centuries, this situation is complicated when civil law once again comes into its own, and then you have a dual court system in Europe, and a great deal of conflict between papacy and empire, between the two court systems, throughout the rest of the Middle Ages. So diocesan litigation, here the bishop was assisted by his archdeacon, who normally presided over the episcopal court. This all grows out of the medieval medieval development in the area of penance. Penance becomes very much of a civil, legal business in the Middle Ages, as we will see when we take up the growth of medieval theology. The bishop was obliged to visit Rome once a year. He was supposed to. Most of them didn't. I don't think we have to worry too much about that. Then, sixthly, the bishop had control, he was to guard or to watch the fiscal rights of his clergy. The tithe was often paid directly to him, so he meted out the fisc, as it were. He controlled the fisc and gave to each priest his due according to the tithe. But he was also required to protect all of the church lands that were owned in his diocese by the church rather than by the feudal lord. The feudal lords who owned the vast areas of property were always encroaching on the ecclesiastical properties. This is one of the problems between church or between papacy or episcopacy and empire throughout the Middle Ages. It was his duty to protect these. Often bishops had their own armies conscripted by the priests in each parish to protect ecclesiastical property against the vassals, the vassal armies of the secular lord. very, very curious kind of activity. Those were the bishop's spiritual duties, but he too had a goodly number of political duties, of feudal duties. I think one of the most important ones is that a bishop was often used as a missi, M-I-S-S-I, which is something like a personal representative of the ruler of the Franks. Let's just use Charlemagne as an example. A better example would perhaps be Otto the First of the Saxons. In order to control their political appointees, the Charlemagne would assign a given bishop to a given area where he was to inspect whether the various capitularies of Charlemagne were being carried out properly. This was a function of the bishop, a political function. Secondly, the bishop was also required to protect and often to ensure regalian rights in his diocese. That is to say, there were dues for roads, for the upkeep of roads. There were judicial taxes, so to speak, things of this sort, for which the bishop, where the bishop was required to ensure this for Charlemagne primarily. Again, this kind of thing was usually paid in kind. Then, thirdly, the bishop was as any other landowner. See, the bishop had control. He didn't own, actually, but he was the feudal owner of lands that were not only controlled, but in many cases owned by the church. And consequently, in order to have them protected by the armies of Charlemagne, he was required to provide hospitality for Charlemagne whenever he and his court, or he and his army, were in the vicinity of the bishop. This was one of his feudal dues. And then, perhaps most important of all, since the bishop was an owner of land or controlled vast areas of land, he was required to provide a certain number of men each year for Charlemagne or his successors' campaigns. Sometimes bishops themselves would go off into battle in springtime. Colton gives many stories in connection with this. And for this reason, then, since both the priest and the bishop were a combination of spiritual and political a figure in a given area, especially when a bishop was to be elected, the feudal lord, and if it was an important enough bishop, even a man like Charlemagne or a man like Otto would be very much interested in who was made the bishop, since a great deal of their work, of the work of a bishop, was done for the ruler of the Franks. The ruler of the Franks was, as I say, very much concerned as to who would be made a bishop in a given area. And this, then, is where this final point comes in, the whole question of investiture. Who actually has the final say in who is to be assigned the office of a bishop and the land? It could not be inherited normally. Even if a bishop had children, the office of the bishop was technically at least, not inherited. Who assigned it then? Since the office was both spiritual and political, there was a great debate within this Christian society as to who should have the ultimate say. Normally the priests of a parish would elect a bishop over a diocese, that is, over a combination of parishes. Sometimes it was not the priests, the rural priests in the parishes that did this, but rather the canons of the cathedral that named the bishop, the man whom they felt ought to be bishop. In the ancient church, of course, when the bishop was the spiritual leader of a congregation and not of a larger geographical area so much, this was done by the people. This was sometimes continued in various parts of Europe, Western Europe, in the Middle Ages, but this was not normally the case. However, the bishop was named. He had to be confirmed by the feudal lord in whose area he served, and sometimes also by the ruler of the Franks, Charlemagne, or his successors. Once elected and confirmed, in other words, once the clergy and the political leadership had agreed on a man, that would be election and confirmation, he was consecrated. The bishop was consecrated. This consecration was normally done by the archbishop, where there was an archbishop. This is something new during the 10th century, the office of an archbishop, or else he was consecrated by either the canons or the priests. And then finally, he is invested with the ring and the staff, which are symbols of his spiritual dash political functions. You see. Now, who finally invests him? Who gives him his episcopal ring and his episcopal staff, which is the final, which finalizes, use that new word too, his position. Is it the clergy, or is it the lay lord? And as I say, in the period prior to the 10th century, it was normally the lay lord who did the investing. So the spiritual element did the electing, the political element did the confirming, the spiritual element did the consecrating, and the political element did the investing. And in this way, of course, the church was completely wrapped up and involved in the feudal structure of medieval society. I have mentioned archbishops. I don't want to say too much about them here, except to note, I think you can read about these men on your own. They are not too important for what I am trying to say here. The main thing about the archbishop is that they normally were this office over bishops, in other words, to supervise the larger areas of the church's life, sort of like district presidents, I suppose, were sometimes the tools of the papacy. This becomes very normal later on, but are sometimes tools of the royalty. And that's why, since there is nothing, you can't really pin them down as representing one or the other. They play a very ambiguous role in these years of the church's life. Okay, then, so I think we can see from what we have attempted to outline here that the views of the roles, as the Pope saw his role in the Christian society, And as Charles saw his role in the Pope saw his role in the Christian society, and as Charles saw his role in Christian society, is spelled out, the ambiguity here is spelled out even further in the feudal structure of the feudal structure of the church, of the officers of the church, the priests and the bishops, in the local area, also in these years. So you have it on the national level, Pope and Charlemagne, as well as on the local level, in the area of who actually finally finalizes or invests an individual into his office. Now, there are two other items that I want to talk about very briefly before we move on into section 3, where the church attempts to free itself from this mixture with the feudal structure. There are two things there. I want to talk about the successors of Charles and then the role of Rome. This is in the period now between, 814, the death of Charlemagne, and 1050 or thereabouts, the time of Gregory the Seventh. The first thing that I think we should emphasize about the successors of Charles, this would be one under C, is that there was no unity in this Christian society after the death of Charles. I don't want to go into this in any detail because I am sure that all of you will be reading this in various texts. It's a story of wars and struggles for control of dynastic struggle, for feudal control of given areas between the sons of Charlemagne and then the sons of his most important son, Louis the Pious. This is settled at Verdun, V-E-R-D-U-N. Verdun is right south of Aix-la-Chapelle, or Aachen, that we pointed out to you last time, where a treaty was made, and the children of Charlemagne divided this Christian society into jurisdictions. They didn't divide Christian society, but they divided the jurisdiction. This is important because the individual who controlled the eastern part of the of Charlemagne's conquest controls what is today called Germany, modern Germany. This is not the division at Verdun, however, in the 9th century is not nationalistic. This is, as you know, one of the great questions between the French and the Germans. Not nationalistic, but rather dynastic or feudal. Nationalism in this area at this time is something, is a curiosity, actually. Because if you're talking about nationalism, then you cannot unite the Saxons and the Bavarians and the Bohemians and so forth. Then this comes out in the end of the 9th century, the beginning of the 10th, when Hugh Capet, the first of the Capetians, takes over the French half of Charlemagne's empire. That's in 888. I don't put this on the outline because it really isn't that important. For church history, and the Saxons, Henry the First, Henry the Fourth, who will be very important for us in our discussions here, takes over the German half of Charlemagne's empire in 918. This is perhaps the greatest importance of the Treaty of Verdun. There is an area in between called Burgundy that plays an ambiguous role. It's a very wealthy area. There's a wonderful book written on it by I lost his name here. White Singer. White Singer. If you're interested in reading about Burgundy, it's one of the most wealthy and cultured areas in the High Middle Ages, the 11th and 12th and 13th centuries. This is the area in between. By and large, at this time, it is independent, loosely related either to the French half or to the German half of Charlemagne's empire, as we know these areas today. We're not concerned too much about the Capetians in this early period because they play no important role. There is little unity in the French half of Charles's empire in the 10th and 11th centuries. We are concerned, however, with the Saxons, and especially with Otto I, because it is Otto I who rules in Germany from 936 to 973, a long period, who continues the tradition of the Holy Roman Empire. In fact, some suggest is the one who actually begins the tradition of the Holy Roman Empire. And he is crowned by the papacy. He is given certain privileges, the privileges of Otto, when he is crowned in 962, but in turn requires that no one can be made Bishop of Rome. If he, Otto, is supposed to protect Rome, no one can be made Bishop of Rome unless he agrees to this. This, too, was not always carried out, but it was the theory. Otto, even more so than Charlemagne, used the bishops as his missi, as his personal representative in various parts of the empire. Now, that's the successors of Charles, but I suppose the basic point would be that the empire, if you can speak of an empire at this time, was extremely weak and fragmented. This is the heyday of feudalism after Charles, where a feudal lord owed allegiance to no one. Every man had his own army. And this same thing affects the church in Italy, with Rome as the center. I think that under D, we ought to say, first of all, that if there is no political, high political unity in Europe after Charlemagne, when his empire is divided among his sons, that one center of Christian society, which is very clearly at least the center ideally, if not in reality, de jure, if not de facto, would be Rome. Here you have a leader. Tragically, however, during these years, the Bishop of Rome was something less than a figure toward which one would look for leadership. Rome itself, the office of the Bishop of Rome, was a matter for constant strife between various groups of Lombard dukes in central Italy, and ultimately becomes a matter for struggle between the German influence in North Italy and the Norman influence in South Italy, each attempting to control central Italy by electing their man to the office of bishop in Rome. In any case, in the 9th century, the 10th century, and the early part of the 11th century, the 800s, the 900s, and through the first 30 or 40 years of the 1000s, the Bishop of Rome is a rather weak individual. He doesn't, if you look over the material, the list of Roman bishops that I gave you and see what they are known for, I think it is very easy. Hincmar, one of the great Frankish bishops during this time, Bishop of Reims, could say, although the empire which our fathers had built into a mighty unity was divided, one thing remained intact despite these domestic divisions, the church. This is true. It remained intact. But the leadership of the church was terribly weak. I'm not going to go into that here. If you are interested in reading about the kind of individuals who became bishops of Rome, my good colleague Philip Schrader, whom at least half of you have met by this time, has a phrase by which he describes the papacy during these two centuries. This is the period, he says, when prominent prostitutes placed profligate prelates in Peter's palace. And this pretty well summarizes it for our purposes here. So in other words, not only was it necessary to revise and to revive the church as it is related to the political half of the government of the Christian society, but it was also quite necessary for the church to free the office of Bishop of Rome from the feudal structure in Italy itself, from this constant controversy. And that's what the effort to do this, to free the church, to give the church both in Rome at its highest level and the bishops at its second highest level, independence of action, is called then the medieval Reformation. The medieval Reformation. It differs from Luther's Reformation in that it was primarily ecclesiastical rather than doctrinal or spiritual. I call this a move toward ecclesiastical independence from the feudal system. This is obviously impossible to be altogether independent. The church can never be independent from the society in which it must serve in the name of Christ. But I say move toward, because they do attempt to extricate themselves from these many ties that bounded them in these years. Now this reform, this effort, actually begins in the monasteries, and the monastery that is perhaps most important of all is that of Cluny. The Cluniacs, the monastery of Cluny, it was actually founded a little bit before 927. The Cluniacs began as a reform of Benedictine monasticism. In other words, this is a Cluniac movement within Benedictine monasticism. These were Benedictine houses that were formed along the lines of the reform of the monastery at Cluny in France. The great leaders of this Cluniac Reformation of monasticism were Odo, Hugo, and Peter the Venerable. I don't mean to be funny here. They attempted to purify the structure and the practice of monasticism, first of all, and in the process of doing that, became the leaders for the purification of the church as a whole and freeing it from the feudal structures. Some of the basic ideals of the Cluniac movement then were the following. First of all, that Benedictine monks in the Cluniac tradition should observe the Benedictine rule. If you take the name Benedictine, then you should follow the rule. This had not been done in the years prior to 910 or 927. Quite often monasteries were set up sort of as marketplaces where a man hired other men and gave them room and board, and they were sort of a trading center in the midst of an agricultural area, but they received the privileges of the church because they took the name Benedictine, you see. Well, this was an effort to straighten this out and to rid the Benedictine movement of this. Ultimately, even the monasteries at the central Benedictine monasteries at Murcia and at Monte Cassino become Cluniac in their orientation. But more important than this, for our purposes here, the Cluniac movement suggests that monasticism should not be controlled, the monasticism in a given area should not be controlled by the bishop of that area, nor should it be controlled by the feudal lord of the area. In other words, the feudal lord has nothing to do with the appointment of the abbot or the prior. And that's, of course, what they were constantly attempting to get their hands into, just as they were able to do it. In fact, they did it. The question was to get them to stop doing it. That the feudal lord should have nothing to do with the appointment or the investiture of the abbot or the prior, but rather Cluniac monasteries should have a loose organization that culminated in the mother monastery in Cluny and owed their allegiance directly to the Bishop of Rome rather than to any other ecclesiastical and or political authority. And in this way, this was their way of freeing the monastic movement, the Benedictine movement, the Cluniac movement in Gaul from secular or feudal control. But they went further than this. The Cluniacs encouraged various members of their orders to enter the priesthood. And this is the beginning of the movement that ultimately then in Western Europe makes the Catholic clergy of Western Europe monastic. This had been suggested by councils as early as the 4th century that all priests of the Catholic Church should be ascetic. However, this had never been implemented, it had never been administered. It's much like talking about programs in the church or even legislating programs, as we often do in our synodical gatherings, and then providing no machinery to carry it out. Well, this is what happened in the medieval church. Cluny, without purposely attempting to do this, became the machinery for bringing about this important change in the Western tradition that all priests in the Catholic tradition, unlike the Orthodox tradition, were expected to be monks. This was not true in the early church. It was and is not true in the Orthodox Church today. In the effort of freeing their monasteries, then, you see, and purifying monasticism, Benedictine monasticism in the Middle Ages, they ultimately are able to spread their ideal even further than the monastery itself. And administer this so that all the clergy of Western Europe are slowly now made monastic. Because I'm afraid that on Thursday and Friday you're also going to have to talk about Innocent III, because I don't think we're going to get that far in class here. If you haven't handed in your discussion of Sullivan, please do so today. If not, right now. Today sometime, if not today, definitely before we discuss it, definitely before tomorrow evening, because after tomorrow evening, they are no longer acceptable. After you have discussed it in class, there's no sense in handing in your own answers.